You're listening to the Whole Hog Sports Podcast. And now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
Arkansas football, another close but no cigar game against Tennessee on Saturday, losing 34-31. We'll discuss that today on the show with Christina Long. Also, we'll have David Seifert from D1 Baseball to talk about the Razorbacks exhibition games at Baum Walker Stadium over the weekend, beating Little Rock and DBU. First, a word from Kendall King.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
There's an old saying that says the more things change, the more they stay the same, and that was the way for Arkansas football on Saturday. It looked awfully a lot like what happened against Ole Miss and what happened against Memphis. It was different in the fact that in those two games they had the ball and they had a chance to go down and win. Against Tennessee, they were playing catch-up in the second half and never got the ball back after they got within a field goal. But it was similar in the sense that they played a first half competitively, and then they came out in the second half and they were really flat. And that's been a problem for this football team this year. Obviously, it was a case against Ole Miss. It was a case against Memphis, against Notre Dame. And really, it was a case against Tennessee. I think the 34-31 score makes this game look a little bit closer than it really was. Credit to Arkansas for going and scoring and being able to put themselves in a position to where if they can get a defensive stop, maybe they can go down and do something and force overtime or pull out a win. They just never were able to do that. But there's something going on with this team this year, Christina, where they just and I don't know if I believe in halftime adjustments. It depends on, you know, some players and coaches say yes, it's a thing. Some say no, it's a total farce. But what we're seeing is that Arkansas in the third quarter does not look like Arkansas in the second quarter. And the teams that they're playing are looking better when they come out of the locker room. And that's an issue that's got to get cleaned up this year if they're going to have any success at all.
Yeah, I expected it to be different this week just because I figured it would have been something that they worked so much on. And I'm not saying they didn't work on it, but obviously whatever it was, it didn't work. But I expected it to be a little bit different. And like you said, it was slightly different in that they were able to score in the fourth quarter. But the third quarter has been the problem, and that was what got them. And I think it was interesting. Bobby Petrino had said before last week's game, somebody had asked him, what do you think's happening? And he said something about, you know, not running the ball particularly well in the third quarter and that kind of slowing the offense down. Well, they ran the ball well in the third quarter. And what was interesting was when he was asked about it postgame on Saturday, he said that, you know, Tennessee did adjust at halftime. They came out with kind of an 8-man front. They were basically daring Arkansas to throw the ball. And Petrino said, I should have gone to throwing the ball sooner. He kept trying to force the run. And I kind of wondered if that was because he believed that the problems in the third quarter before had been because of an ineffective run game in third quarters. And they didn't run the ball great in the third quarter, but it was okay, statistics-wise. They had some losses, some tackles for loss a little bit on Mike Washington. So the numbers were a little deceptive there, but I think I was wondering if that was maybe part of it. And he was saying, you know, I should have gone to just throwing the ball sooner and maybe we would have been in a different situation. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing that was at play there.
Turnovers are the problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you look at the drive chart here in the second half. They're moving the ball. Six plays, 61 yards. Seven plays, 35 yards. They had a three and out. They had a five-play drive that ended with a fumble. 10 plays, 81, 7 plays, 80. So they're moving the ball. Moving the ball has never been the problem with this team, last year or this year. If you want to look at total offense, they're always going to be near the top in total offense because they put up good numbers of yards against teams that are good teams. Tennessee would qualify. And then they put up massive numbers against the teams that they overwhelmed, the Arkansas States or the UAPBs or Mississippi State last year, Oklahoma State. The problem is turning this into points, and that's been a two-year problem. That has been a problem with Taylen Green as a quarterback and Petrino as the offense coordinator, and a lot of times the root of that problem is the turnovers. Mm-hmm. And we talked about it in the preseason. I said, you know, there are people who didn't like what I said about Taylen Green in the preseason, but I said I'm on the fence about him because he is turnover prone. He was turnover prone at Boise. He was turnover prone his first year at Arkansas. And we're seeing it again this year. Interceptions are down. He's throwing the ball better, but And you heard Petrino say this after the game the other day. He has got to be better with his ball security. He had three fumbles against Tennessee, lost two of them. One of them, at I guess both of them, were really critical points in the game that could have made this game potentially go different. It does not get better, and I don't know that it's going to get better.
Yeah, Petrino was asked today about what he saw on the two fumbles that Talen lost, and about, if he chalked that up to a Talen problem, protection, a bit of both. And he said, I'll read you what he said on the first one. He said the first fumble was simply not pass protection at all. It was a naked play. Unfortunately, it was to his left, and he's got to know if I'm in a position where I am with that defensive end and the ball, I just have to tuck the ball in my left arm and get as much as I can. He's trying to overdo it and do a little bit too much. And then he said the other fumble was, he said, that's a hard one. He thought he was going to make a big play, and you saw the play. There's only so much I can say, because that was the one where they reviewed and, did it come out of his hand? Mm-hmm. When was he moving his arm forward and everything like that? So I think he wanted to not say too much there, but he maybe disagreed with the call. But I thought what he had to say about the first one was interesting, especially after, it's so interesting because it's not as if they haven't worked on it. Yeah. It's not as if they don't recognize that turnovers are a problem. We've been talking about it since preseason because of what a problem it was last season. Mm-hmm. It's not as if they're not repping it. It's not like they're not teaching them anything. So it's very strange the way that we've seen this just continue to plague them, especially like in big spots.
And it always, I shouldn't say it always, there are so many times though where it feels like it is a momentum,
yes,
game-changing type, yes, turnover where, hey, if you don't, if you don't throw the pick six against Oklahoma State, are they able to come back?
Yep.
If you don't have the turnover against Missouri, if you don't have the fumble at the goal line against LSU, all these different things are just like those are the, you look back at the course of a game and say, well, the game was competitive until that point, or Arkansas was in control until that point. And it felt like that second one on Saturday against Tennessee, that was really one of the ones that, okay, now they've lost grip on this game. And they're going to have a miraculous finish to be able,
exactly,
to pull this out.
And, they had gotten lucky on the first two, the one by Russell and the first one by Green, that Tennessee didn't turn into points. But those still mattered because of the fact that it killed your ability to kind of get ahead. So it's just, it's baffling that they just keep doing it. They just can't stop fumbling.
Yeah. What was it, the 19-yard line where he lost the second one?
I think so.
On the Arkansas 19 and against Texas A&M last year. Again, you can go through almost every loss in the last couple of years, and it may be unfair to point out that, just single out Talen Green because there are other players that contribute to these losses, but the turnovers have just put them in such a bind, like really bad turnovers in an inopportune spot on the field, like A&M, 10-yard line. Well, they go and they score and they win that game by 4 points. I don't know how it gets better. I really don't.
Yeah.
Other than just say, hang on to the football. And some of it, like Petrino said, it's him trying to make a play. And I don't know that they're as successful as they are offensively without the times that he tries to make a play and he is successful doing so. And sometimes it's just you have to take the good with the bad.
Yeah. I want to ask you something. Did you watch Petrino's post-game press conference or did you just read it?
I did not watch the full thing. I watched some of it and then read the full transcript.
Were you surprised at all by the tone of the press conference? Because I was in middle school when Bobby Petrino was the head coach here before. I was not watching Bobby Petrino post-game press conferences and paying attention to what he was saying. So going down there, I was in Knoxville. Going down there, I was interested what the vibe was going to be after a loss. And it was surprisingly upbeat to me. I mean, I guess
chill.
I didn't expect him to be in a rage, but I was kind of surprised, and this is not a criticism, this is simply an observation, just because this is my first time covering Petrino as a head coach, and I was wondering what you thought. I was a little surprised. It seemed like there was a lot of emphasis on moral victories that surprised me, and you and I talked about this on the phone earlier, he was not shying away from mistakes. He was owning up, the decision to kick the field goal rather than go for it. He was kicking himself for that. He was owning up to mistakes, and he wasn't pretending like the problems weren't there, but I think I was surprised by, somebody even tried to ask him a positive question saying, hey, you only had one penalty, does that make you feel good? And he said, well, what doesn't make me feel good is fumbles and not going for it. So it wasn't that he wasn't that he was ignoring problems. I just, the overall vibe was so much more positive than I was expecting. And I was curious for your read on that.
I don't know. I think that whenever you get it handed to you like they did against Notre Dame,
that's true,
and you have the head coach gets fired, not just the head coach gets fired, but you know, for all these defensive players, like
their whole staff.
I hate to say they're buddies because I don't want it to sound like that's
the case.
But they
care about, you know, it means something to them.
People they like, and they're upset about them getting fired. I think you're probably curious in the back of your own mind to say, what's this going to look like?
Mm-hmm. I definitely was.
I would have to think that whenever they stepped on the plane to go to Knoxville, you're not 100% sure of what is this going to look like tomorrow. And so I would think that the way that they competed and made it a close game would have to be, and again, he's an interim coach. He's not the full-time coach. I'm sure that plays a factor in how you view all of this. But I would have to think that there was probably some pride about how that went down. Now, is it going to be that way if it happens next week in Staying In or the week after against Auburn and so on and so forth? Probably not. But for that one game, after the 2 weeks that they had just endured, I could see where there's disappointment in not winning, but some pride in the effort.
Yeah. It's amazing how the script flips when, you know, they were losing close games and it was, gosh, they have to stop losing close games. Sam Pittman can't win a close game. And then Bobby Petrino loses a close game. And it's like, he did so good. Yeah. Which, you know, and I get it. I'm not saying that that's incorrect or anything, because obviously the situations are different. But it's just interesting how this is, they kind of did the same thing they've always done that everyone kind of got mad at people for. Now, yes, there was more effort. It looked different on the field. I don't want to say eye test, but it was different and yet similar. And I just find it interesting the way the conversation is different as soon as you change the name of the coach.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of people who are rooting for Petrino to be to get the full-time job. And so they're gonna look at this through Petrino-colored glasses.
Right.
What would a Petrino-colored glass look like, by the way? I don't even know.
I don't have any idea.
Gold? Is it silver? Is it? I have no idea.
I feel like he's more of a silver vibe.
Okay. We'll reset here. We'll tell you that.
That threw me off.
Kelsey Music is coming to the Hogs Illustrated Sports Club. This is going to be Thursday up in Springdale at Home 2 Suites at noon. Still time to get your tickets. OzarksTix.com, OzarksTix.com for Kelsey Music, the Arkansas women's basketball coach. Also, upcoming luncheons on the 23rd of October. We've got Mitch Mustaine. Obviously, that'll be kind of interesting to hear him. And then we're finally able to talk about this on the 30th, October 30th, same website, OzarksTix.com. We're going to have Matt Hobbs, Nate Thompson, and Bobby Wernis, the Arkansas assistant baseball coaches at the HI Sports Club for kind of a roundtable discussion about Razorback baseball. So we're really looking forward to that one. Again, you can get your tickets for any of those at OzarksTix.com. Okay, let's reset after the Petrino colored glasses thing. this was a weird weekend in college football.
Yeah.
James Franklin gets fired at Penn State, and they're paying him $49 million to go away. I was reading something about his contract. I don't think he has to mitigate this. So I think he gets the $49 million. It's very similar to the Jimbo Fisher deal. I think he gets the $49
million. He doesn't have duty to mitigate?
I don't think so, based on what I've read. Now,
that would be crazy. I mean, did Jimbo know?
People,
I didn't realize
no, he
Jimbo
didn't have,
didn't.
Jimbo did not have the duty to mitigate.
I don't think
that's
I remember.
That's why he's at the ACC Network right now.
I don't think I remembered that. I don't even think I knew that.
Yeah. I mean, A&M said, hey, you know what? We print money down here. Here's $76 million of it.
Does he? Does Franklin really not have? Wow.
But the point being, I think I'm really interested to see what happens with him, because now he's going to be in the conversation, I think, for any of these other Power Four jobs that are open, including Arkansas. Whether or not he's a real candidate, I don't know. But this is the type of candidate that I think some of these schools were hoping, hey, they come open. A Mike Norvell might be another type of candidate. See what Florida State does as the season goes along. I got all kinds of different ways I can go with this whole James Franklin thing. But I guess the first one is, I would think that if I were Franklin, whether it be Arkansas or a program like Arkansas, that would be the type of place that I would want to end up at. Because at Penn State, he averaged almost 9.5 wins per year before this season. And it was never good enough for him. Like they were always unhappy. It was always, well, he didn't win Ohio State, or he didn't win Michigan, or he didn't win the Big Ten championship game, or he only got to the Final Four of the playoffs last year. You do that kind of stuff, you even come close to that kind of success at a school like an Arkansas or a UCLA or an Oklahoma State, like, they're going to celebrate that because their expectation levels are different than, say, the top 10 to 15 schools that are out there. So I'm interested to see if, in reality, he could become a player in this coaching search at Arkansas or in one of these others. And by the way, the coaching market just continues to get way more crowded. Penn State made a change. Oregon State, which is obviously a different level. UAB made a change. I think that we've already talked about how it's going to be a crowded market at the end of the year, but this is like it's going to be so crowded by the end of October. Because what does Florida do? What does Florida State do?
What does Auburn do?
Like there are a lot of those type jobs that are out there where, okay, now these guys have fired their coaches, and so now we have to talk about these four coaches, and they're on the hot seat, and then maybe, you know, because they're being talked about at a national level, the internal heat there in the building gets turned up, and then also maybe there's this fear factor of, well, if we don't get in line right now, what's going to happen? It reminds me of when I pick up my kids at the elementary school. Their school gets out at like 3:10 in the afternoon. And by 2:35, sometimes you can't get in the parking lot. Now, pickup doesn't go any slower. Like, you can still get your kids by like 3:25. It's just you may have to sit out on the highway instead of sitting in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happening with a lot of these schools is they're like the parents who, hey, we got to get into the parking lot. When you can sit out on the highway and you're still going to get a coach, you just may not be in line for as long. This is a really, again, this has got unprecedented levels of coaching change written all over it that we're going to see this year. Penn State's open. What happens at Florida? What happens at Florida State? What happens at Auburn? Are there other big programs that we're not talking about right now? Because that has a trickle-down effect on the jobs like the Arkansas, Virginia Tech, Oklahoma State that are in that tier two, tier three territory.
I was talking to somebody about this last night about, you know, the possibility of it. Would James Franklin be a candidate at Arkansas? And I think you're right about, you know, a program like Arkansas. You know, James Franklin's thing was he was pretty much good for 9-10 wins. You know, he was going to get you a decent number of wins every year. He just wasn't going to get to the level that Penn State wanted, which was, you know, the big game James thing. He was going to lose to the ranked teams or to the top, you know, opponents and not be able to get it done. But for an Arkansas, you know, for a program like Arkansas or of Arkansas stature that's trying to just get to that point where you are having consistent, you know, not just getting to bowl eligibility, but consistently, you know, winning 8, 9, 10 games, that's you're trying to even reach that level right now. I think, you know, that makes sense to me. I also think, you know, another national title contender program is not going to want to bring, you know, Florida that wants to get back to competing for national titles. They're not going to probably want James Franklin, right? They're going to look at his, you know, track record recently, and they're not going to want to hire him for the reasons that Penn State fired him, which was not being able to win the big one and things like that. And I think for a Florida, like, you know, a team like Florida is in a different situation than a team like Arkansas. And they're kind of on a different tier right now. And so that's kind of how I feel about it. So I'll be very interested what his next move is. I'm trying to figure out if he does have a duty to mitigate. I think he does.
Okay.
I can't figure out. No one seems to know for sure.
Regardless.
The same reason no one seems to know the exact buyout number. I've seen 48, 49, 50, and 56.
Yeah.
So it's somewhere between 48 and 56.
I would take
which
one.
Which is a lot.
I would take a million. Like if somebody wanted, there is not a better job out there right now than to be a college football head coach. Because once you are a college football head coach, you have won the lottery. Yep. You have won the lottery. It doesn't matter if you're good or not.
Nope.
Chad Morris never won an SEC game at Arkansas. That guy got paid like over $10 million to go away, and he never won. That's the difference between being a college coach and the lottery. The lottery, you have to win to get your money. Being a college football coach, you don't have to win.
Yeah.
Like, it's insane. It is insane to me that these schools keep agreeing to these long-term contracts that are going to balloon the buyout. The state of Mississippi, if nothing else, the state of Mississippi has figured this out. They cap the years that a coach can be under contract in any state employ in the state of Mississippi to 4 years.
I forgot about that.
And
wow.
So a coach can't, you know, Lane Kiffin, his contract can never be more than 4 years. Now, you know, there's no threat that they're not going to continually renew his contract, but it's going to cause the buyout to be a little bit probably, I say probably because I don't know for sure what's going on at Ole Miss, but it's probably going to cause the buyout to be a little bit less than it would, you know, if you were getting the 10-year Kirby Smart deal or the 10-year James Franklin deal or the 10-year Jimbo Fisher was on a 10-year contract. I just can't understand why they keep doing this. I talked to a coach one time. I'm not going to say who it was. It's somebody who was really good, like a really good coach in his field. And he told me, he said, when it comes to football contracts, a non-football coach, but when it comes to football contracts, he said, the schools do not have the negotiators in their athletic departments to basically match wits with the agents. And the agents are taking them to the cleaners over and over and over and over again. And it's only going to get worse. Like this year, it may totally reset the market in a negative way for the schools from a buyout perspective. I don't know that this gets any better.
That was going to be my next question to you, is there anything they can do? Because, you know, there's also been talk for years about just how coach salaries are so inflated. But it's like the line just keeps going up. There's nothing that can make line go down, mm-hmm. really. Like, I don't know what you could do to make that happen.
Like, in the NFL, the players get more than the coaches.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, if I think we're a long way from that in college sports. But if we ever get to that point, that might make the coach salaries go down some. No, I don't know how you fix it. I really don't know how you fix it. You know, the only way I can think of that you can fix it is to guarantee the same amount of dollars. But in order to do that, you have to give them like a significantly higher annual salary. Hey, instead of paying you $6 million a year, we're going to give you $13 million. But in the event that you get fired, we're only going to give you $3 million to go away. Maybe you can do it, but again, you're still paying all that money. It's it's so lucrative to be bad at your job in college football.
Yeah,
it really is. There are no ramifications for being bad. Sam Pittman, losing record, here's $7-something million to go away. Chad Morris, you never win an SEC game, here's $10+ million to go away. Brett Bielema, you know, falls apart on you at the end. Here's like $12 million to go away. And that was negotiated down from like 15. It's insane. Yeah. I'm flabbergasted by it.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why the schools keep agreeing to these long-term contracts. Like they're so scared. Well, Sam Pittman won 9 games. Let's give him 5 years and basically a sixth. If he made a bowl game, he was going to get a sixth year. Why? Like, what? Who was going to take Sam Pittman? You know, and a lot of these schools, they fall for this.
Yeah.
They're so scared that, oh, God, he gave us one good year. Who's going to take that guy? You know, if it's Kurt Cignetti, sure.
Different.
You know, that's a different deal. But there ain't a lot of coaches that are doing what he's doing.
Right. And Indiana gave him a huge contract.
If you're a good leader, head coaches are this way. You're not as scared to lose assistant coaches. And I would think that if you're a good leader in an AD position, this is risky business. I get it. But you shouldn't be afraid to lose a coach. You should be so confident in your ability to identify coaching talent and in your atmosphere that you're setting them up in your program that if they want to go somewhere, that's fine. We'll just go find somebody else. I tell you who's done this really well is Oregon. Oregon, look at the turnover they've had at their head coaches, whether it be Chip Kelly leaving to go to the NFL, Mario Cristobal left to go to Miami, Dan Lanning, I don't know how long he'll end up being at Oregon, but they seem to be okay with, you know what, we'll just go find somebody else. And sometimes it's out of their control why the coaches leave. But like, get to that point if you're an athletic program, not to the point that you're so scared that you're going to lose the coach who had your first winning record in 7 years, that you're going to handcuff yourself to him for the next decade.
Yeah, and it's not just Arkansas. I mean, this is a problem, you know, across college football.
It's a pandemic.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Cignetti, by the way, he has got to be a thorn in every AD side right now. Because I want to pull this up. I was looking at this the other day.
They signed him after last year to a really long-term deal, didn't they?
Well, and they should.
Yeah.
We took him to the playoff.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that sounds a little bit counterintuitive because it was his first year. But this was Indiana, by the way, before Cignetti got there. this is just this century, okay? I'm just going to stop at the year 2000. I'm going to read you their records. 3-8, 5-6, 3-9, 2-10, 3-8, 4-7, 5-7, 7-6, one winning record. 3-9, 4-8, 5-7, 1-11, 4-8, 5-7, 4-8, 6-7, but they did make a bowl game. 6-7, but they did make a bowl game. 5-7, 5-7, 8-5, 6-2 during the COVID year, 2-10, 4-8, 3-9. That's Indiana football. And then this guy comes out of nowhere. I mean, like a dadgum hurricane, and he wins 11 games his first year. He's got them. They may be better this
year. They're better.
They look like they're better this year.
They definitely are.
Like, where did he come from? Every AD right now is so frustrated because it's like, you're telling your fans, hey, you know, you got to have patience and you got to build a program. This guy just came in, and I mean, like, not only is he winning, he's winning at the highest level with a program that has never won in
They're genuinely
decades.
Making it look easy. Like, you can just decide to start winning. It's crazy.
And so, I don't know. I would feel like he is a thorn in everybody's side right now. But then he's also, like, if you're an AD, like, if you're Hunter Yurecek and your job is open, Cignetti does not have the normal, like he has a very abnormal back record, for lack of a better term.
Like, background?
Background, there you go. Yeah. You know,
track record, background, you smooshed me.
I
know where you're going.
Yeah, thank you. That's why we work well together. You know, he was like at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, which how does that even work? I don't know. It'd be like the University of Arkansas at Iowa. I don't get it. There, and then he goes to Elon, and then he goes to James Madison. And it kind of underscores my point that I tried to make a week or so ago, like with DeBoer.
Yeah.
If you can win at one level, at a really big level, and then you go and you have success, like maybe at a group of six type school, I think you're going to be pretty good if you can get into a power job, as long as your vision aligns with what they're trying to give you there. And I would think that if you're an AD right now, you're like looking under every rock. Okay, who's winning in the MAC?
Yeah.
And where was he? And you know, does he have like an NCAA Division III national championship somewhere in his closet? Cignetti is a force of nature right now.
Yeah.
Problem is, there's only one Kurt Cignetti, and there's a whole lot of others who may have a similar background who are not going to be like him.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what's so hard, and I think that's why there's so many different directions you can take a coaching search. You know, you can go for a young guy that's kind of energetic and interesting, innovative. You can go for somebody that's kind of that middle, and that's kind of, I feel like, what I like is kind of like that middle range in terms of age and experience, where they have been able to win at some level. Like what you were talking about. I actually, you really convinced me when we were on the show, I guess it was last week, talking about kind of what Arkansas should look for and what a lot of schools should look for. And so I don't think you need, I don't think you need a retread. I don't think you need a veteran head coach. And you talked about needing proven, and I agree with that. I don't think you can necessarily get somebody that hasn't been a head coach, but I think you can get somebody that's been a head coach at a lower level if they've been successful enough. And I think, it's hard because it's always going to be a little bit of a gamble. Mm-hmm. And like you said, there's only one Kurt Cignetti, and you can't ask every coach you hire from whatever level to do just like that. And that's why, like you said, ADs are probably cursing Kurt Cignetti for having so much success so early, because that's not the norm. And you can't expect that from guys. You can't look at it and say this is what's going to happen. It's different in the portal era. It's different because you can import most of your roster from a successful team. It is different. But then what happens is, okay, after that first year, after those first 2 years, after those guys are gone, how have you attracted new guys to your new rosters at your current school? So it's harder. It's still more of a gamble because of the sustainability aspect. But I think it's just been so interesting to watch his rise and kind of look at what it means for sort of coaching generally.
It's insane
that
he's doing this at Indiana. It'd be like if Missouri went and found a baseball coach. I mean, seriously, this is insane.
Yeah, you're
Indiana is, like, they're not a football school.
No.
Are they going to become one? I don't know.
They're trying to. I think they're enjoying it. I think they're enjoying it. Football, hey, being successful in football makes you a lot of money. I think, it costs you a lot of money, but it makes you a lot of money.
Can they hold on to him?
I don't know.
And again, that's going back to with like Penn State being open and some of these others that we think might open up at some point. What is the domino effect there? Like, remember when Musselman got hired at Southern Cal, mm-hmm. the whole domino effect. Mm-hmm. And didn't it start by SMU firing its coach or something? I mean, it was crazy. So there's a domino effect here that could potentially happen this season. That because, you know, Indiana, if their job's open, okay, now we've tasted success. We got to go get us a good coach too. This has just got this is a weird year.
Yeah.
This will be really, if you like coaching searches, and most college football fans do, they love them a good coaching search. Like, they're going to really love what's going to happen and transpire between now and, say, like mid-December because it's amazing. Let's see here. I think that's all I got for you.
Yeah. Are you guys going to talk basketball tomorrow?
I don't know what's going on yet tomorrow. We're still working.
I was going to say, there's basketball news.
So where she's going with this is that the SEC basketball tip-off, which is another word for SEC media days, is happening in Birmingham. John Calipari and a couple of players, and Kelsey Musick and a couple of her players are going to be there. Ethan Westerman and Anthony Christensen are there. They were also, by the way, at the open basketball practice in Hot Springs yesterday. There's a lot of coverage on our website at wholehogsports.com where you can look at that as well. Christina, appreciate you being here. When we come back, David Seifert from D1 Baseball will join us to talk about the Razorbacks exhibition games over the weekend against Little Rock and DBU. First word from Kendall King.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Hey, welcome back. I want to tell you about our friends at Bentonville Glass. They've been serving their community since 1971, committed, professional, and versatile. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look for no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can come by and see them now at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at bentonvilleglass.com. Arkansas baseball had two exhibition games over the weekend, defeated Little Rock 8-1 on Friday night and beat Dallas Baptist 5-3 on Saturday over at Baum Walker Stadium. David Seifert from D1 Baseball was there for the second of those games, and he joins us now. David, what was your big takeaway?
Well, it's kind of a typical Razorback, right? The pitching dominates and the offense does just enough. Got hot in that one inning, and that one inning kind of carried him through. But it's always good coming to Fayetteville and seeing all the prospects year after year that the Razorbacks are putting out there.
I thought defense really stood out to me on Saturday. I mean, there was the great play in left field by Brenton Clark at the end of the top of the ninth inning. Now, Arkansas was going to bat in the bottom of the ninth regardless of what had happened, but that essentially, you know, won them the game. If that ball goes over the fence, it's a 5-5 game. But it wasn't the only play. I mean, Mike Anew, I thought, looked really good in center field. You had infielders making slick plays throughout the afternoon. And this is a team, Ryder Helfrich didn't play. Nolan Souza, you know, we know that he's coming back from his injury. It just seems like that's kind of been the hallmark with Arkansas right over the last 5 years or so, that they're going to put a really good defensive product out on the field. And I thought that's what stood out most to me about Saturday was defensively, I didn't think DBU hit nearly as bad as their offensive statistics might have shown. Arkansas just took a lot of hits away.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you had Pompey over there at third base looking like Brooks Robinson, just snaring this, diving for that, you know, throwing across the diamond. He was super impressive. And from what I understand, he played shortstop the night before. I guess he looked pretty good there too. But as you mentioned, Mike Anew running down every ball in center field. The one in particular that stood out is he must have ran, 70, 80 feet on the kind of little blooper into short center field. He got there just in time. I mean, that's 70 major league range. That's near top of the scale range in the big leagues. And you mentioned Clark's catch at the wall. Yeah, it's a tie ball game if that ball, you know, goes over his mitt. But they were definitely everywhere. And Rob Nett had some nice plays, nice picks over there at first base. But yeah, without a doubt, it was pitching, defense, and just enough hitting in that one inning.
It's funny because Arkansas, their department videographers, a lot of them were in Knoxville for football, and then they're having a basketball practice, an open practice down in Hot Springs. So they didn't have anybody at the ballpark to get video of Clark's catch. And I was talking to somebody the other day, David. I said, if that's a catch in a real game We're talking about that catch all year long because of the moment, but then also just the play. It was an incredible play by him.
Yeah, in my eyes on that fly ball, I thought it was just going to be, you know, a fly out maybe to the track, right? But the ball kept floating and carrying there. All of a sudden, I'm like, okay, at the wall. And next thing you know, he's jumping and he's catching the ball over the wall and bringing it back. And that was kind of like the last thing I expected. I wasn't thinking it was going to be that type of play. But yeah, that was a fantastic catch. ESPN top 10 catch any week of the year in the spring.
I told the people at baseball, I said, I hope maybe you have like some surveillance videos, some cameras that got a video of that where at least you can see it from some angle. It was awfully impressive what he did from offense.
Well, maybe one of those Cessnas flying by the entire ball game might have something for us.
Yeah, possibly so. What offensively, Arkansas, like you said, it kind of was slow go for them. They didn't hit until the seventh inning, and then they scored all their runs in that inning. And this is an incomplete offense that we saw on Saturday. Again, Helfrich didn't play. He's been an incredibly consistent hitter throughout the offseason. We'll see what Nolan Souza turns into once he's back from his injury. But from what you did see on Saturday, I wonder what you thought about their lineup.
Yeah, it's probably not as deep as last year's. It probably reminds me more of 2 years ago. You know, where it's good, it just kind of didn't have, you know, I don't – as much as I like Aloy and New's going to be just fine, he's still got a sharp and swing miss against the breaking ball. He kind of got looking maybe too heavy for the breaking ball and got frozen stood by a couple hittable fastballs. But all in all, the way Arkansas develops players and the players just get better, it's going to be a solid lineup, probably somewhere between last year's and 2 years ago as far as overall production. But they definitely have the pieces. You know, you take Helfrich out of the middle of that lineup, obviously that's a big loss for that day. And then Souza, I've always been a Souza fan. Last year, I came to watch the Oklahoma State series when they played three games, and Souza stood out for me, you know, in that, and he's only going to get better. But again, at the end of the day, I think it's going to be a solid lineup, maybe not like a top two or three lineup in the SEC, but it certainly will be a good lineup and a dynamic lineup as well, just with the speed at the top and some of the extra things they can do. They're certainly not going to be a station-to-station type of team.
Pitching-wise, what were your thoughts?
I really like to see Hunter Dietz. I mean, he was obviously still coming back, still getting 100% healthy. Saw him the Cape. It was kind of a letdown, if I'm being honest here. It was kind of like, oh, he's only 90-92. And yeah, it was the end of the summer, you know, and he's still building up arm strength. But his as much as anyone's like, okay, he's back. He's 94-96. I think he touched a 7. He spun some good breaking balls. He just looked strong. His delivery was tight. And those were two really good innings that kind of coming in. I'm like, okay, just from my Cape look, he is who he is. I mean, he's really good. He's always been really good, always been a top prospect. But you're like, oh, that's probably a fourth or fifth round type of guy. But what I saw on Saturday, I mean, that's a guy you're talking top 40 picks right there. If he can just not only sustain, but, you know, continue to build, continue to throw strikes, and, you know, the improvements just as he gets healthy and progresses. Steele Eaves, just what a competitor. Cole Gibler, another elite competitor. I know Gibler gave up a run and a few hits. I don't want to say it was a lucky home run, but the big first baseman for DBU just ran into that mistake from Gibler, and Gibler paid for it. But, I mean, those guys are just – I mean, they're solid. They're just going to be solid every day. And I've always been a Tate McGuire fan too. I know his velo was down a little bit on Saturday from what I've seen in the Caper in the past, but I just think he just adds depth to what didn't – you know, there's no Wiggins, right? There's no Gackle. And then I missed all the power arms on Friday, but that's going to be really another really good pitching staff.
With Dietz, you know, Dave Van Horn said last week that he thought he was throwing like a conference starter. Now, whether or not, you know, he's one of the top three on their staff, I don't know. But if he can reach his ceiling, what do you think his ceiling is? I know you said maybe a top 40 pick, but in terms of how effective he could be in college baseball during the 26th season.
You know, I'm not sure where Gackle, you know, are we talking about Gackle as a starter, or is he, you know, going back into the pen? But certainly Dietz is going to be one of their four starters, I would think. And then from there, just no matter how many strikes he throws, right? I mean, it's hard to hit 94, 97 from the left side with a breaking ball, but he's got to throw strikes. He gets behind, then he becomes predictable, and then we just go down that, you know, that street. But, man, his ceiling – For Arkansas's you know, two is pretty much everybody else's one. I mean, when you boil it down. So, yeah, I mean, I know I'm not really giving you a straight up answer, but he's definitely a rotation guy, but he's got to continue to be that guy that we saw on Saturday, but also continue to develop, you know, a third pitch and command more than just control.
DBU is a great program under Dan Heefner. I mean, they're in the postseason. It feels like just about every year they're moving to the Pac-12 in a couple of years. So that gives you an indication of how good they've been. How good did you think this version of DBU is?
Very good version. I mean, I thought as good as Arkansas's defense was, I thought DBU played really good defense as well. I mean, they were everywhere. You know, they made good plays. They made all the routine plays. Outside of, I think, one play where they kind of threw the ball around a little bit. I don't think there's an error on it. It was just an overthrow and kind of got a little ugly there for a second. But they're always solid defensively. I love their center fielder. I know he's 0 for 4 at the plate, but Sartain, he's a sophomore. He's a really good player. And then they just had really good college baseball players up and down their lineup. But overall, a real good team. Their top first four pitchers combined for 6 shutout innings. Because they threw strikes and they brought in some other kids that maybe didn't throw, were not so fine with their control. But that, I would say that's a top 25 team, you know, heading into the spring.
I know you go around in the fall and you watch a lot of these different exhibition games where teams play other teams that come in. One of the things that jumped out to me the other day is that it's the exhibition ends at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon and there's a Razorback football game going on. And I don't know how many people are in the ballpark, but it's in the hundreds. I mean, I would say probably over 1,000 people were still there at the end. Is that normal based on some of the other ballparks that you go to this time of year?
Well, I was in College Station on Friday night. Not trying to one up the Razorbacks here, but it was announced at 5,900.
Wow!
And now there wasn't a college football game. You know, there wasn't a football game going on, but there were plenty of other stuff going on. But they had 5,900. It was packed. I mean, you could move, but there weren't any open seats. So, I would say, even with 1,000 that Arkansas did have there, that's not typical. I mean, you know, traveling around, you'll probably see, you know, 400 or 500 here or there or whatever, but. And then I was up, I was up at Notre Dame on Sunday and there was probably just a couple hundred there. So yeah, definitely Arkansas always has its support, definitely out of the ordinary. And just the funny thing is I thought if there were 1,000 people there, 500 were still yelling at the home plate umpire.
Yes.
So I thought that was, you know, par for the course as well.
I was texting some people that
some things don't change, right?
I was texting some people that I work with. I said, Razorback baseball fans don't have any chill. I mean, they were on that home plate umpire from almost the get-go on Saturday, and this was for a fall exhibition game in October. David, I like
they knew his name. Even more impressively, they knew his name, too, so that was good.
They did. They had done their homework. I like what these what the NCAA's done here in the last 6-7 years by allowing teams to go out and play these games. I just feel like, you know, used to you could do this, but it would count against the number of regular season games that you could play. So, like, you know, Texas might play Stanford 3 times in October, but then they could only play a 53-game regular season schedule. I like this, and I would have to think the coaches really appreciate being able to get a look at this version of their team against another team before the games that really count.
Oh, without a doubt, I wish they would up it to, you know, I wish they'd give them 58 games, and then but the 58, whatever you want to play in the fall, you could play. So if you want to play 2, you still have 56 for the spring. But I wish they just give them 58 combined between fall and spring and just go that route too. I think softball does something like that maybe. But yeah, I wish it was 58, play whatever you want in the fall. If you want to play 4, play 4, but then you only get 54 in the spring. And I'm not trying to play less college baseball, but a 54-game season would definitely probably – improve the quality of baseball, at least in 2 games during the spring season where, you know, pitching might be run thin in this week or that week. But but with all that said though, I think we're right in the same area, right? Mm-hmm. 56 games in the spring and in a handful, 2-3 in the fall, because they can also play, you know, an international team that doesn't count. And there are ways around the hard and fast 2 outside competition games.
That's always fun in the fall. I mean, just kind of a little bit of a reprieve from the long college baseball offseason, getting to see the teams get out there and play against each other. I had a lot of fun watching it over the weekend. David, hope you enjoyed your time in Fayetteville, and I hope we see you again during the regular season.
All right, I will. I'll be there. Thank you.
All right, David Seifert of D1 Baseball. We appreciate him. We also appreciate you being here on our show today. Hope that we'll see you again tomorrow or at our website, wholehogsports.com. Have a great day, everybody.